radio, online, and on digital.
The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne
and on ABC Victoria.
John Safran, who's my co-host today, he's the host of Sunday Night Safran on Triple J, and he's also had a whole bevy of TV shows that have landed him in all sorts of trouble, and he's come here for his latest controversial adventure.
Now, last time,
is that right? Or
last time I was on with you,
yes,
we're talking about the new Scrabble word
That's
list.
That's true. We were, yeah,
which had just been released. If Jonathan Holmes is listening, the Media Watch host, I'm actually a bit worried because I talked about the Scrabble word list, the new Scrabble word list coming out from England, that was whatever.
Yeah,
and then the next thing I know, this parcel arrives.
Yeah.
From England, and it's the 1,000-page hardcover fat new Scrabble word list. So,
this is like cash for comment.
And the note was, oh, we heard you talking about the Scrabble word list or whatever. I don't know how they heard in London or whatever.
And Scrabble people here.
But it was sent from London, and they sent me...
Yeah, but they just would have got in touch with head office.
Yeah, sure. But basically, I spoke about it on ABC on air. And the next thing I know, I get this present in the mail of exactly what I spoke about.
So you worried?
If it's a thin, weak Jonathan Holmes on Media Watch, I can give you that. But you know,
are you worried that you have to declare it or something, or send it back?
You do have to do that.
Do you?
If you actually sign a contract with the ABC, absolutely, you have to declare interests.
Because but receiving a Scrabble dictionary from a listener?
No, it wasn't a listener. It was from the publisher,
somebody.
HarperCollins, Rupert Murdoch. I'm in the pocket of, or he's in my pocket, whatever's happening.
You're in his pocket because he's
Rupert Murdoch. I'm a shill for Rupert Murdoch's Scrabble Dictionary via HarperCollins, and they're sending me stuff as kind of payola for talking up the new HarperCollins, Rupert Murdoch Scrabble
word list. It wasn't a problem until you came in here and started mentioning it again, because this is you now promoting the dictionary after the fact when you've already received it.
Because you'd think this would happen all the time. It actually doesn't happen. Like, I can't really recall things. But years and years ago when I was on Melbourne Public Radio Station, Triple R, and again, you don't really get... community radio.
Yeah.
You don't get, sent... You know, you get sent CDs and books and stuff, but that's it. But anyway, one time I was on air, and I talked about how I'd gone... And it was true. I'd gone to the shopping centre because I was thinking... I just want to spend more time at home and I'm sick of going out or whatever, but I've got nothing to do or whatever. So I was about to buy a Nintendo GameCube, which was the thing at the time.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I just mentioned that on air and did a bit of shtick about it. Next thing I know, at this community, this sort of filthy...
even find the building.
Where it's grotty and whatever. Suddenly this sparkling new Nintendo GameCube arrives, right?
Why do I have a feeling you're about to just name drop a whole lot of products?
No, this isn't a trick. Anyway, and then I could tell, because then I opened up and I had all these co-hosts, and they're all thin and poor because we all only got paid $150 a week or whatever.
Gee, that's quite good.
And then I open up this game and I can just see the look in everyone's eyes, like this was going to be trouble. Because why do I get the GameCube whilst the others don't or whatever?
I see.
And it reminded me there was this film once on ABC, this British film, in black and white from the old days, and it was all about this guy who wins the lotto.
Yeah.
And then it's like it goes through the ebb and flows of at first it's wonderful, but then everyone gets jealous around him and then it tears his family apart. And I think the end of the film is him in the gutter because he's been kicked out because of all the consequences of him getting this reward that other people didn't. So that was going through my head. So then, you know what, I gave it to... I gave it to Canteen, that...
Oh, yeah. They do bandanas.
Yeah. And because I just didn't want to...
Canteen means, cancer for teenagers.
They do bandanas. That's their main business.
Yeah. No, what I meant was... Yeah. That was, sorry.
If you're...
Yeah.
No.
Okay, you've
seriously,
exposed me.
No, if you're looking for a bandana, if you're looking like... Yeah, if
you want a bandana, Canteen bandanas are good ones.
Yeah, if you're like a Guns N' Roses fan or something.
No, the reason I remember that is because I got a couple once. I think I was at a fast food restaurant or something and they just gave them to you with the chips or whatever it was you ordered. And that's how I learned about Canteen. So it was clearly an effective marketing strategy.
I did pretty much instantly regret giving it away to a charity as I was sitting at home that night. But probably in the long run, it was better.
So you did that to preserve your social
integrity. Standing. Yeah. And also because around the time that that happened was actually on Media Watch, there was all that stuff about Cash for Comments and
but
John
this
Laws.
Isn't Cash for Comment.
The Nintendo.
Yeah.
There was, something just felt wrong. You know when they say, I don't know what pornography is. I can't describe pornography, but I know it when I see it. It's right. Like, I don't know what Cash for Comments is, but I know it when a Nintendo arrives and I've talked about it and it's
awkward. Cash for Comments quite simple.
Yes.
That someone pays you to say things in their favour.
Sure.
But not making explicit that it's an advertisement.
Sure.
So that you actually develop an editorial position and state it for the benefit of those who've given you something. This hasn't happened. You said something and then someone sent you a thing.
Can I just say the Scroll Word List has a wide variety
this could be Cash for Comment right
now. Wonderful words that will help you win a Scrabble game from Zoe to Chi.
Yeah, okay, so this is... Now that, you're
now,
in
now that's Cash
so
for Comment.
You shouldn't have done that because... this is the sneakiest Cash for Comment ever because you've come in on the pretext of being conflicted about it.
I hope Mark Scott doesn't tweet about this. You know Mark Scott, the head honcho at the top of the pyramid of the ABC?
You got an award, a Queen's birthday honour thing.
He like tweets or whatever, yeah. So he could be furious right now. But he's got himself in trouble,
why
Mark
do you
Scott.
Why keep digging? I don't understand
why. Do you know why
you
Mark Scott's got himself in trouble? Because he started doing this thing where he wishes happy birthday to ABC staff members, right?
Oh, no.
Where can that end? And then it becomes this thing, because Mark, frankly, you're drawing, are you saying that if you're employed full time,
yeah,
that you should, they get privilege and they get a birthday, happy birthday, but us kind of like outsourced people who work just as hard, are you making some comment, Mark Scott, comparing the outsourced contract workers to the permanent staff by not saying happy birthday to us outsourced contract workers?
You're really firing on all cylinders, aren't you? It's just like you're bringing the big guns. You want a birthday message. That's what this is about.
Well, it's not my birthday yet, but Mark Scott.
When is your birthday?
I'm a Leo. But Mark Scott, all I'm saying is I'm warning you. I'm like the canary in the landmine? No, in the
coal mine.
In the coal mine. Yeah. I'm the canary in the on the landmine who's telling you, Mark Scott, that if you only send happy birthday tweets to permanent employees, like, there's going to be grumblings.
So, there'll be an uprising of casual workers.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, it's like one of those little things.
But isn't the point of the casualisation of the workforce that Labor becomes flexible? So if there's an uprising of the casual workforce, you just sack them.
Well, thank you, Karl Marx.
Hang on.
What?
Was I being Karl Marx?
No.
Was I being...
I
could have been Hayek at that point.
Yeah. Selma Hayek.
No. Friedrich von Hayek.
Okay.
Yeah. The free market guy.
Sure.
I could have been either at that point. I wasn't making... Yeah. I'm just saying, the point of the casualisation of the workforce is that you got greater flexibility. So an uprising from casual workers is hardly going to be scary, is it?
Yeah, sure. No, you are right. Don't worry about it, Mark Scott.
Shouldn't you be saying, make me permanent, and then I want my
birthday
message?
My dad would prefer if I was a permanent staff member. That's his main problem. He doesn't care that I go around the world lighting myself on fire,
right,
wearing blackface
that's
on crucifixes. He doesn't care about that. He's like, John, it would just be nice if like you had a more secure job. So, Mark Scott, if you're listening...
Well, you're doing
wonders. Yeah. Can I do something at the ABC that's like not outsourced? I can do anything. Well, you know, I can learn how to do the twiddly bits in the control room.
Okay.
In IT.
There might be a whole lot of people who'd rather you just swap right
I'm
now.
I'm sure there would. I'm sure there's people who would.
John Safran is my co-host for the day. Justin Hazelwood will be joining us. He's known perhaps better as the bedroom philosopher. He's got a single out, a new single, a video clip, and he's got an album out, which I've been listening to, and he's very good, and he's embarking upon a national tour, and he'll be joining us soon on The Conversation Now. But before him, we'll be joined by Lawrence Leung, who you will have recognised from other earlier TV programs where he's doing breakdancing and the like. Not too dissimilar to you, John Safran. But he's got a new series coming to the ABC called Unbelievable. And we'll be asking him what that's all about in just a moment here on The Conversation Now.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Our first guest today is Lawrence Leung, a man that you've seen before on a show called Choose Your Own Adventure. Very original title, incidentally. And now has a new program that's about to air on ABC One starting on Wednesday. It's called Unbelievable, And Lawrence is quite nervous because he doesn't know what to say because he's worried that he'll give it all away.
Yeah,
I invite you to do that this morning, Lawrence. Welcome to the program.
Hello, it's great to be here. Hi, John. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
Yeah, pretty good.
This is a very John Safran type program, actually. Well, I was talking about that off
air. He's probably like in his head and he's probably trying to position himself differently. That's probably like the worst thing he could have said.
Yeah,
to
I'm aware.
Well, it's tough to answer a question now that you're in the room, John. Is it a John Safran type show?
Well, only in a positive, original, in your own original way.
It's done differently.
Okay.
But the idea, the sort of the myth-busting element it's almost guerrilla style.
I'm pretty vain, but I probably didn't come up with that.
Yeah, that's true. Look, all right, I'm going to come clean. The only reason I said that is because you're here. If you weren't here, I probably wouldn't have even thought of it.
Now, the first episode's about psychics. It's pretty good.
Yeah, the first episode's about psychics. I mean, the whole series, I guess... I've been trying to explain it to people. A lot of people lately, obviously, interviewing me about the show, and I'm trying to boil it down to a sentence, and it's really hard to do. Is it, you know, Mythbusters meets Ghostbusters? Is that the type of series? Is it a skeptical series, or is it a comedy series that has a bit of science in it?
It's definitely a skeptical series.
It's skeptical in the sense of the word being, I guess, asking questions to find out evidence-based conclusions.
It's more than that, though.
Well,
this is the kind of show I could imagine people who are skeptics of the kinds of things you discuss. So the things, there's six episodes.
Yes.
Maybe we'll do it this way.
Yeah, let's do it this way.
So the first episode is devoted to psychics, the second episode to ghosts, the third to UFOs.
Yes.
The fourth to magic.
Magic, see, that's, I'm not skeptical about magic.
Oh, is that right?
I love
fifth,
it.
Manipulation, and the sixth, the experiment.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means.
I'll explain.
But I've only seen the first two because that's all you were... charitable enough to give me on the DVD. but from those first two, if you were a person who was skeptical of psychics and skeptical of the existence of ghosts, this is the kind of show you would make.
Well, it's a type of show that those types of people would probably like to watch. What I do is I went out there to try to find out whether these things existed. I've always been really interested in psychics, ghosts, UFOs, ever since I was a kid. The only difference was, I guess, when I was little, I tried to be the Jedi Knight that made the pencil move across the desk, much like Luke Skywalker trying to move the lightsaber. I don't have psychic powers, so I wanted to research that. And when I was...
I don't have psychic powers, so I wanted to research that. I want to
have psychic powers.
I don't have psychic powers either, but I don't know. I've just never been moved to research it.
Oh, well, I have been.
Yeah.
And so I guess I would call myself more of a reluctant skeptic, which means that I want to believe these things. But so far, unfortunately, the rational explanations seem to be getting in the way.
You're kind of Agent Scully.
Agent Scully and Mulder together.
Right,
together at
body.
Last. Yeah, yeah. Sounds like slash fiction. I really want to believe. So I decided to put myself into situations where the most possibility of experience these strange occurrences would happen. So I went to Roswell in New Mexico to meet UFO hunters to try to find aliens. I stayed in a haunted castle in the north of Scotland. And I met psychics and I've even met skeptics as well. So I guess this series...
You mean even met skeptics?
Even met skeptics being there are organisations for skeptics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's conferences.
Conferences, yeah.
You went to one.
I did.
And you tried to convince them that you were psychic.
Why not?
Right?
Why not? They've got $1 million challenge and for people to prove their psychic abilities, and I thought I'd give it a go. It's much like, a reality TV show, really.
Right, okay. So you saw it as a game show. I'm just going to rock up and see if I can claim the prize.
Yeah.
And you failed spectacularly, didn't you?
Let's not give away too much.
That's not giving away much.
I already admitted I'm not a psychic. So yeah.
You've basically already exploded that myth.
Mm-hmm. Now, but you were freaked out in reality because I know your director, and he was in episode one, this guy who's trying to demonstrate that things that look like they can't be have... There's a trick to doing them.
Yeah.
Does this amazing thing where he drives totally with his eyes blocked off in the car. And you knew this guy must have some way of doing this.
Yeah.
But just to clarify that, because people might be thinking, oh, you put a band, a bandage or something, and you can still see through it. No, this was like he had coins
gaffer taped
on his eyes and then gaffer taped basically his whole face.
Yeah, this was really freaky.
And what city was he in?
We were in Las Vegas, and he wasn't from there. He was there for a part of some sort of skeptics conference, and I interviewed this guy because he fooled a whole bunch of universities back in the 70s. People thought that he was a psychic, and he was just a teenager. He could bend spoons, do all that type of stuff. And then, you know, he came out in a press conference and said, no, I'm actually a magician. And it was just an experiment to see whether the most, you know, scientific and rational people can also be credulous as well. So I interviewed him in a car, but the difference was, of course, he had coins gaffer taped over his eyes with a blindfold. And I even held up these coins to the sky to see if there was no holes in them. You know, when I put the blindfold in, I checked if he had any earpieces in his ear. Like, I really wanted to see how he's going to do this.
So
and then just before getting in the car, we stopped, and as our, you know, production crew, we sort of went, hang on a second, let's call back home. So we rang the ABC legal department and said, I don't know if we can go through. Are we allowed to go through this? What if we crash the car? What if you know, we hurt people? And they said, okay, well, put him on the phone. And they asked him all sorts of legal type of things, such as, you know, are you a practitioner of whatever they call this blindfold driving? Have you ever hurt anyone before? And to his credit, as a professional, he never explained how he did it, but he guaranteed somehow to the ABC legal department to let us go in the car. Lawyers. Yeah, well, yeah.
But why were you... You knew he was a magician.
I knew he was a magician.
But why,
I had no idea how he did it.
Yeah, but why, if you're such a skeptic, were, because you were freaking out in yeah. that car whilst he's driving blindfolded. And I know the director, he was freaking out. You were like, ah, ah, ah.
Yeah.
I was freaking out watching it. It's hard to watch because.
So how do you reconcile that with the fact that you're a total skeptic?
Yeah, I'm not a total skeptic, but he's a magician, not a psychic.
Yes.
And he actually says, I'm doing this without any claims to be a psychic. I'm using some sort of other secret methods. And the point is if I can do this and I'm not psychic, what does it say about people who do claim they have psychic abilities? So what he's, I guess, saying, and part of his what he does is he debunks fraudulent psychics. And he I guess because he knows all lots of tricks of the trade. And in this demonstration, without telling me how he did it, and I wish he did because I'd love to be able to drive a car blindfolded.
Well, you did have a crack at it.
Well, not very well, obviously. If I knew the secret, I'm sure I could hit Vegas like he did.
No, but it's amazing because he wasn't just navigating traffic. He was pointing out things.
Yeah, he would go,
there's a car backing up over there. And...
Yeah, he was pretty close. He would go like, there's a dumpster there, and it wasn't a dumpster, it was like a truck. But
oh yeah, that would be part of his theory. That's what made it so good because, especially at the start, he sort of like pretends there's some sort of complication, like, oh, am I driving in the middle of the road? And he's going over the
bumps in the road. Yeah, yeah. Ever the showman. It's really interesting because people like Uri Geller, who many people consider to be psychic, and a lot of magicians consider him to be a fellow magician because they reckon he's just using sleight of hand, you know, distraction and manipulation, misdirection. He would often get on TV appearances where people like James Randi, who's a noted skeptic, would sort of, you know, give him all sorts of like cutlery to bend that he hasn't seen. And so live on air, he'd have to do it, but he'd sort of say, oh, no, it's not really working for me today. I'm not really concentrating. And people thought he was more psychic because he didn't do these things because it means that he's more human.
Right, so he's being authentic.
He's being more authentic, and that's why I think maybe this guy who's doing the blindfold drive, in much the same way, and he admits he's a magician, he would do a bit of, oh, not getting a hang of it yet. Is this a manual? Am I in the right gear? But who knows? I mean, he definitely did it very well.
So can you find out how that's done?
How he does it?
Yeah, have you got the means to try to...
I want to ask him. Like, you know, I've got his email.
You know he's not going to tell you, though.
Yeah, he's not going to tell me. I mean, he'll probably think I'll just say it on the radio.
Yeah, exactly. Do you know some guy who works with him, is a minder, or who might be, you know, wanting a career change or something?
Yeah, yeah. Or does he practice it? Like, can you sort of go to where he practices?
Training sessions.
Yeah, yeah.
John Edwards. Edward or Edwards?
Edward.
Edward, yeah. Who's had that American show that was shown on Channel 10 a few years ago.
Yeah, it was called Crossing Over.
You cover him.
Yeah, he's a guy who can talk to your relatives, but they're your dead relatives. he used to do live shows as well. He came to Australia back in, I think, 2003, and he did arena spectaculars. And I took a young lady along to, I wouldn't, well, maybe she didn't consider it a date.
you did, clearly.
Yeah, but in hindsight, you shouldn't really take a girl to a show about someone talking and channeling the dead. Yeah, yeah, it's probably...
Oh, it might have been a bad date, but...
It was a bad date. But, you know, she totally believed that he was channeling the dead. We had a bit of an argument about it.
First and last date?
Yeah, it was. It was. Right. And I had written down... I had a little notebook with me because, you know, as someone who is interested in this area, I wrote down everything John Edwards said about the audience members. You know, I see, is there someone here who has lost keys in this area of the audience? And so I wrote down every single thing he said in a notepad and ticks and crosses as the audience was validating them. And he got heaps more crosses and barely any ticks. But it doesn't really matter because the audience wanted to believe and they believed he was
John. I wonder if it was the same one that I went to. I went to a John Edwards one, when he came to Australia. Was that the one where he was talking about Elvis Presley? Do you remember that?
I went to a Melbourne one. He came a few times.
Yeah, I went to this Melbourne one where he was going, oh, I'm getting this vibe, Elvis Presley. And over there, right? And then this guy stands up, he goes, and he's like, just anything about Elvis Presley? And the guy's going, No. And then, okay, I'm just wondering if, like, at some point you went to Graceland. No. And it's going through this, right? And then finally the guy, it's almost like because he's under so much pressure because it's like 1,000 people looking, he goes, oh, I think maybe on our wedding night, we did dance to an Elvis Presley song. And then the audience, rather than going, this shoot proves John Edward is like a bull crap artist.
Yes.
That they turn on this guy going, oh, you idiot, of course. It was so obvious.
Why did you not think of it before?
Yeah, you jerk. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Well, at the start of these shows, he says, oh, it's called psychic amnesia. So some of the messages that are coming through, you'll get on your way home as you're driving home, you go, oh, yeah, the lost keys.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, not many people have lost their keys.
No.
So if you get that, that's a very specific prediction.
Yeah, bang on.
So, all right, 6 episodes.
Yep.
But you said one of them you weren't skeptical.
Oh, it's not a show about skepticism.
No, but you were responding to my assertion that it was.
Basically,
you weren't skeptical about something.
Yeah, yeah. It's about magic. The show's basically about games of perception, whether things are in our minds or are they really out there. And the first half of the series is about the paranormal, so psychics, ghosts, UFOs. The magic one is one that I'm really interested in, that's episode 4, because I want to investigate how magicians fool us, because these are guys who tell you that they're going to deceive you, they're going to lie to you, and then to your face they keep their promise, and then they actually follow through and deceive you, even though they've told you that. And so I wanted to work out how, and so I've met some scientists who study magicians, and I met some magicians around the world who are like experts in their field, pickpockets and things like that, to talk about misdirection. And then using all that stuff, I'm going to see if I can try to fool a master magician with their own tricks.
All right.
So that's that episode.
You're certainly not afraid of making a fool of yourself in the show.
I guess it's kind of more fun to, you know, if you poke around in these unusual areas, I think, you know, you can make fun of, like, skeptics as well as the world of the unknown. But I think it's more importantly at the end if you just not take it too seriously and you can make fun of yourself.
We're getting texts. One texter suggests that the blindfold driving was done by using one-way coins.
One-way coin.
I don't know.
Well, I tell you what, I flipped those coins around as I looked up into the sun, and he had a blindfold on, and we gaffer taped.
That's pretty good.
Over the coins.
And someone has given us a website where there is an explanation of how the blindfolded drive is done. Should I give it out?
No.
Oh, yeah, don't ruin Lawrence's.
No, you don't want to ruin. I don't want to ruin the magician's tricks. I'm ethical like that.
I'm going to try to restrain my freedom of speech because...
Oh, no.
It's right here. Here's the website.
You can't plug someone's website.
Why not?
We can look at it after the show.
Plug it your show.
Yeah.
You can plug a website, surely.
Oh, go for it.
Oh, no, I reckon the magic is better. You know, I reckon it's more interesting not knowing.
All right. I'm not going to say it.
Well, people can look it up after they
see
it.
But anyone who's interested can find their way to it.
Yeah.
Apparently, I haven't been to the website, so I don't know if it actually does. But there is apparently an explanation of how the blindfold drive is done. It's like that quick change thing. That's another one I've never been able to figure out. That's
what
like
you mean?
A magic trick.
You oh, where they change their clothes really quickly.
Instantly. I've never been able to figure that out. And the obvious explanation is that they've got something under what they're wearing. But then they do tricky things. Like they'll wear something that's like legless. So like a leotard or something that's legless. And then the next one, they're wearing pants. It's like, sorry, you can't just stuff that under a leotard and expect people not to notice.
It's not like, you know the Eiffel Tower disappearing or cars levitating. It's how do they change their pants really quickly?
Yes. Well, what's wrong with that?
That's
suggesting that's not a worthy inquiry.
No, I'm just saying it's the most relatable magic trick ever.
Someone suggested how they do the blindfold thing.
Mm-hmm.
They said they drive the same circuit over and over again, but that wouldn't answer how they know that this car's backing out and
yeah. Well, we went through traffic. Yeah, I reckon people should. I just see it, and then we'll discuss it afterwards on the forums.
Okay, that's very well handled by you. The network is very pleased with that answer. And just one final question: how's your mum?
Mum's all right. Yeah, she's good.
She gonna call in the middle of this interview? Or
I hope not. I haven't been thinking about her. Like usually, you know, people call when you think about them, don't they?
Yeah. Well, this is you barely start the show because you're getting so many calls from your mum. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. You got to stop thinking about it. Lawrence Leung, the show is called Unbelievable, and it's 6 episodes every Wednesday.
Yep, that's correct.
So for 6 weeks it runs. What's that, holding down the Gruen transfer slot or something?
It was the Hungry Beast slot.
The Hungry Beast slot.
Yeah, but it's after Angry Boys at 9:30.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, there you go. Well done. What a great night in on ABC One. Okay, even now I'm making myself a bit nauseous.
Don't forget Margaret and David at the movies after that.
Followed by the most incisive look at the day's events in news on Late Line.
Without the movies, by the way, when they review Australian films, knock off 1.5 stars from what they give the Australian film.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
they're supporting
the
local industry.
Yeah. You can tell it in their eyes. Sometimes they're sort of...
All right. That's John Safran delivering nuggets of wisdom.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Joining us in the studio now, wearing the pink-white socks of peace.
Hey.
Justin Hazel, good morning.
G'day.
So what do I call you?
Justin's fine.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm kind of a bit disappointed, actually.
How about Betty Phil? That's reserved for my special friends.
Betty Phil.
Haven't known you that long, but...
No, that's true, but, you know...
Shoot you forward to Betty Phil's status.
All right, good. Actually, it's a bit awkward. I'll just call you Justin.
Well, okay.
So, your last album, Songs from the 86 Tram, I listened to it over the weekend, and the thing that immediately struck me was the number of Melbourne references. How did it go outside of Melbourne?
Well, there's 14 Melbourne references in all. And there's, you know, you're choosing to ignore the 863 non-Melbourne references.
That's true. So, although I can't think of that many references to other places.
Looking at the maths, I think it's a common misconception to sort of try and pigeonhole Songs from the 86 Tram as an album about Melbourne or about tram culture specifically. I think in the grander scheme of things, it's an album about public transport
right. And
about Australia.
It's deeper than just,
yeah. I think
it's quite academic.
Look, the thing is, the main, I guess, the mega hit "Northcote So Hungover," 250,000 YouTube views has.
Is that how you measure a hit now?
YouTube views, yes.
All right. Well, that's not very good because you don't make much out of a YouTube view.
No, someone could tell me how to make money out of YouTube. I could.
It's been done, but I don't think.
Pay off my credit card. But I guess like that's been winning some awards in US film festivals and whatnot. And a lot of skeptics. There were a lot of skeptics that said it's not gonna work, Justin. It's not gonna work outside Melbourne.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a reference to Pony, which is a bar in Melbourne. And you think back to as a kid listening to Monty Python sketches and whatnot, and there's always references to British politicians and British places.
That you don't get.
Your brain just goes, oh, okay, I can tell what they're doing there, and you insert, you know, your own local reference. That's what I like to think.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's clearly not putting a brake on anything.
No.
Yeah.
The I read about you in this book I'm reading for, cause I'm interviewing the author later this week, David Nichols. And the book's The Bogan Delusion. And there's an interview with you in it where you talk about straddling the Bogan hipster divide.
Hmm. It's an interesting argument. I guess he was asking from my point of view because I guess I've done some sort of personal transformation from growing up in Burnie in Tasmania. Now living in sort of Thornbury in Melbourne. which is sort of...
You said both of those place names with a lot of pain in your voice and on your face.
Mm.
Was that, are we meant to read anything into that?
Yes, it's best to read a lot into it. I'm sort of, you know, ultimately the sort of personality that's never terribly comfortable in whatever demographic I'm in. So I spent most of my childhood rebelling against the rural Tasmanian sort of country suburban vibe and going, no, I'm you know, this isn't for me. And sort of the artist in me was always, you know, being the perennial outsider and sort of, you know, I'd be judging them quietly. And then I sort of come to Melbourne and spend enough time living in the hip northern suburbs to the point where I like to sort of, I'm now romanticising about the country boy in me and like going, well, I'm never going to turn into these hipsters, you know, these latte sipping, Frankie magazine reading types. I'm always going to be, you know, more down to earth because I've got the Tasmanian upbringing. So yeah. I've sort of manipulated myself to whatever side of the camp I'm in, I'm always.
Right, so you're always not what you're accused of being, is that right?
Well, being a Gemini, I think my personality is quite adept at being, you know, split into two modes of being. It just depends what sort of company I'm in at the time.
You realise, I mean, you write for Frankie magazine.
Yeah, well, it could be any magazine. I said Frankie, but it could be, you know, it could be
Yen. Search your local
big issue.
Give it people listening.
That's neither here nor there.
I've just got a feeling that whatever we insert, the point that's going to be made is that you're ultimately exactly in the set that you're trying not to be.
Look, I think to spend too much time trying to, you know, I think it's ultimately a lost argument. It's counterproductive. And I think what we should be focusing on here is the art that I've created, which, you know, ultimately I could say whatever I want now, but nothing I say here is going to express my point more than, say, the songs on Songs from the 86 Tram, which, you know... I'd like to answer this question in three parts. Now, if I can interrupt myself, I'd just like to refer to the fact that while Songs from the 86 Tram is ultimately 12 different characters, you know, you'd have to say there's a piece of me in each of them. So while I might appear like I like to hide behind masks, I think, you know, ultimately it's quite an intimate and vulnerable expression.
Now, one of
part.
The songs on
that
album...
I don't think you believe anything you just
one
said.
Of those songs on the album...
No, I have to disagree with you.
One of the songs on the album, Sudanese, you do audio blackface, controversially.
Black voice.
Yeah.
Yes, it's true. And I guess, it's one of those things. I kind of love how you want a sort of politically correct veil a lot of us are sort of trapped in now, because it's just so fun to see people seize up. I think it's really important. It's never been a more important time for, art, but most importantly, comedy. I think one of comedy's great roles is to diffuse tensions like racial tensions in Australia. And, you know, you get into that sort of point where people are like, oh, don't mention any other races or do anything vaguely because that's racist, right? And people just get into this stupendous... negative argument of you shouldn't
it's
mention
a Frank Woodley moment there.
You shouldn't mention any other it's stupendous, it's superfluous.
Exactly.
You shouldn't mention any other race for fear of offending them, which is quite racist in itself. And
but
you know,
this isn't about mentioning a race, this is about impersonating it.
Yeah, so I mean I just thought I can't do a album about public transport in Melbourne and not have, you know, a multicultural element in there, if I may, you know, use that word. The red hot element,
racist,
if you will. See, this is my point. So I'd expect more from you, John. So yeah, and so it was a great challenge for me. And so I wrote the lyrics, and I actually sent them off to a person who works with the Sudanese community to make sure they weren't offensive in any way. And yeah, there was a lyric that I think it was like, "We have things here that they don't. They have things here that we don't have, like Rage Top 50 and Bubble O' Bills. We just have militia pops, which is a angry face holding a licorice gun." That was the lyric, which I thought was pretty funny. But
they got rid of it?
Yeah, well, the guy I sent the email to said the Sudanese community is quite tired of being associated with warfare. So I was like, that's fair enough. It's not
I can totally understand.
Intent to
but
be
it's
offensive.
Interesting that you chose to run it by someone.
Well, I guess I don't normally do sort of political stuff. I'm normally sort of, you know, whimsical, absurdist man. So it was quite new territory for me, and I was a bit pretty nervous about it, but at the same time determined to, you know, just push some boundaries.
Well, because for all of the controversy that may attach to it, it would be hard to argue that the message of the song isn't sympathetic.
Yeah, I mean, it's just I think people's first sort of fears is that you're going to be sort of making fun of that people, or, you know, but there's so many other dimensions of humour. Most of the humour's about Australian culture and the idea of someone, you know, trying to get used to predictive text. I sent a text message to my relative. It said, "Hello, aunt," but it came out quite different. It's basically, yes. You know, imagine
I
someone...
I come from a place that's got a lot of violence, Collingwood.
All this I moved there to get away from a place of great poverty, Footscray. So it's cool.
With your Northcote So Hungover music video, I saw on YouTube that there was like a spin-off of that, that a tram company actually, they remade the video and you did it as a parody song. But that came out before your actual Northcote So Hungover video. Is that the first time a spin-off has come online before the actual thing that it's based on?
Yeah, it wasn't sort of, it wasn't a genius piece of marketing on my part. I won't be giving talks in schools or businesses about how to launch things. I sort of, I guess it was like a piece of irony on my part of parodying my own song, which is virtually a parody of a character, for to do a song for Metlink, who, you know, offered me a suitcase of cash to do it. And by that I mean a suitcase of Johnny Cash singles, because being a hipster, I'm into rare country records. But, yeah, I said it came out before. The parody of Northcote film clip came out before the real thing. And so everyone started attacking that. When I say everyone, I mean three cynical people on a music blog. But when you're in Melbourne, that feels like everyone.
That is everyone. That's everyone.
Yeah. So it's been interesting. But, you know, gee, I just love talking about hipster culture. I never get bored of the hipster argument because it's just so interesting.
But then why do you only have that? Because that's the only song really on that album, at least.
Yeah. That's my... you know, that's Beck's Loser or Radiohead's Creep. Everyone's sort of focusing on that song, but there's 11 other tracks on the album.
Right, and you have quite a broad palette, actually. Like, the characters that you inhabit are quite diverse.
There's a middle-aged mum on there.
That's how you start the... That song sounded a bit Pink Floyd to me.
Oh, right. I thought it sounded a bit like Anthony. Antonina Johnson's. I'm not sure this is the direction I wanted to be going in.
I can just imagine...
talking about Preston.
Yes. This is what I mean, though, by the Melbourne references.
Okay, you got me there. Yeah. But again, you know, every city in Australia has got its Preston, and every city in Australia has got its 86 tram. You know, it might be the 423 bus in Sydney.
So do you change it when you tour?
I do a bit. I mix it up. I do a bit, yeah. There's like, in the middle-aged mum song, there's a lyric, I'm going to Flemington to buy Lady Remington. Oh, I love my life. So when I was in, I was on Bunbury ABC in Western Australia, and I chucked a bit of, I'm going to Busselton to buy Lady Remington.
Doesn't quite rhyme.
But it doesn't matter because a local reference always gets you there.
Oh, yeah.
That's true.
I've noticed that. Like, you go to a concert, I'm convinced when you go to a concert and they say, oh, hello, whatever city you happen to be in, they don't mean it.
Kings of Leon just have to get the name of the city right that they're in, and people just lose their minds.
They
said Melbourne. They know where they are.
Whenever you see a Hollywood actor coming to Australia, they always have to say kangaroo or koala. We went to the zoo. I caught some koalas. Like, we think, oh, wow, local reference. Great. Mm-hmm. You caught a koala.
Fantastic. Oh, right. You referred to a cliche. Brilliant.
Now, Justin.
John.
We have something in common. Because I also, about 10 years ago, I released a novelty. Although you probably don't see your music as novelty. Oh, okay, sorry. No, I'm quite different to you.
No, that's okay. I actually call it prog novelty.
Yeah, sure.
Novelty songs
quite different
that go on
to you.
Too long.
I released a novelty single called Not the Sunscreen Song, which was a parody of Baz Luhrmann's
I own the single. It's a great release. Inspiring.
And I talk, like, in his song, it's all this positive stuff addressing students. I twisted around, so it's all this negative stuff addressing students. But anyway, this has got a point, by the way. There were a couple of Australian references in it, like to Adelaide. In fact, there were lots of them, to Perth or whatever. Mm. And because the song became successful in Australia, the Shock Records said, oh, we can release this overseas because, you know, the Baz Luhrmann song's being released overseas too. But they'll go, oh, no one in England's going to know where Perth or, like, it's not going to make... So I actually re-recorded an international version.
Really?
Right.
Yeah. Where
it made reference to, and I screwed it up though, because for example, I made reference to like being a hoon at the soccer. Whilst if you're in,
you would never say
yeah,
that.
Yeah, if you're in Britain, you don't say soccer, football, and it took out all that like the Adelaide Perth references and just put in other lines. I can't remember that, and there was like they pressed them up and. I've got some copies, but it just didn't work.
Did anyone buy it?
No, it didn't work. It was like, right. And it just sounded, it was like this thing where, even to my ears, it just sounded wrong. You're like, you can't even quite put your finger on it because you're kind of going, oh, how can changing seven lines in this song that goes for 6 minutes, how can that ruin it? Because the lines are almost, in theory, kind of the same. And it just didn't have that je ne sais quoi.
Right.
That sold 25,000 copies, which, you know, that's probably about 250, the equivalent of 250 YouTube hits.
Yeah, well, Northcote only sold 3,000 singles, but the fact that your single came out, John, at a time when no one could download it.
Well, actually, so singles.
I've actually worked out the math.
I know, okay, 3,000, that's actually... Yeah. 27,000
in the old old language.
It's like metric, really,
but it's not a competition. Look, I think it's a statement of Australia's sort of round the clock grand intimidation with the rest of the world that we sort of can't. I mean, how can you have a voice as a culture if you're always so quick to change the lingo and the language in the material for fear of UK or US audiences not getting it.
Because it certainly doesn't happen in reverse.
No, which makes me quite cranky. I mean, how many references to New York street names do I have to hear in a song compared to, you know, I try and write a little album about Melbourne and everyone's like, what are you doing? You know, and that's a terrible impersonation of you, Waleed. So,
Jay-Z had the, and Alicia Keys, when they wanted to release their Empire State of Mind New York thing, they had people on their case just like you going, what are you doing, man?
Yeah,
really? No one's going to be.
I'm being sarcastic.
Something about Flinders Street.
It was just a bit hard to tell.
I get a little bit passionate about, the idea of, trying to capture an Australian voice, and it seems like such an uphill battle to forge and maintain an Australian voice when we're, 20 years of being bombarded by American and UK culture. And I pretty much grew up in Burnie being really cynical about Australian like music and movies, and I didn't even own an Australian album until I was about 21, because I had this sort of rock hard idea in my head that Australian albums weren't as good as US and UK albums. And I guess I've spent a lot of recent times trying to counteract that by sort of overcorrecting to such a point where I do go and make an album that's like ridiculously about like really completely specific, because I don't know, I just think it's important for the kids to be able to
see themselves reflected in the
What do you think about the Australian hip hop scene, how many decades ago they started off, well, not many, but a couple of decades ago they started off with American accents, and then slowly more and more Australian accents are in Australian hip hop music. Totally Australian. I've heard a song all about like fish and chips and scallops and things like that.
Yeah.
Rhyme a lot with scallops.
Yeah, I tried to. Well, on the We Are Tramley, the hip hop track on the album, I was trying to. I realized, in comedy, no one had a crack at doing the Aussie hip-hop voice. All right, this goes out to my Bundoora crew. Come on. It's that kind of... It's like aggressive larrikin accent, which is it's this really interesting hybrid. I think it's a good thing. But then, when they started doing that, like the backlash was just violent.
Yeah.
Like you could just...
You were having a go at...
Oh, it's just the cultural cringe. You can just see when Australian cultural cringe, of which there is, there's nothing like it in the world than the Australian one, I think. Like, the amount of people, sort of Triple J listeners, that were going, oh, just say that Aussie hip-hop, there's nothing worse, I hate it. People were making a real point to come out and go, how dare they try and rap in this voice when it's hip-hop's this authentic American thing, as if, like, so it's okay for rock bands to play rock music, even though they didn't technically invent it here.
Yeah.
There's weird double standards, which... Aussie hip hop seems pretty popular now, and that's good.
Oh, I had this discussion with John on his show last night. Actually, is skip hop a term, or did I just make that up and think I was talking about something that existed?
Yeah, I think it's like, it's the new trip hop or something.
I've heard of trip hop, but when I said skip hop for the first time, I did not think I was saying something new. I thought I was referring to... Maybe I outcooled myself.
I think your listeners should jump on the forum and write to
I'm
you.
I'm sure there's a website.
There's a website that we can tell.
Skip Hoppy is.
And you've just been congratulated by Denise in Chelsea for saying the word cranky. It's a very Australian thing to say, apparently. We've got about, 40 seconds left. So I just wanted to ask you one question. You can answer this yes or no.
No comment. Go.
Okay, well, that's done. So we've got a bit of time. What do we do? Just sort of hang out or...?
Yeah.
What's your favourite song on the album?
Look, it's like children. You can't pick a favourite. But no, it's
come
deep
on,
down,
pick one.
Deep down you have one. I guess I like Old Man at End because it's, I get to do this two-minute bit of prog, Pink Floyd prog out at the end.
It's good too, by the way.
Deep down, I'm just a frustrated musician.
Yeah,
trapped
well,
the, in a
I was going to ask you
body.
How seriously you take the music, but we've got 10 seconds left, so I can't. But
you'll find out at my national tour, which is
which the details of which you don't know.
It's barely booked. It's mid-August.
That's all we can say. The Bedroom Philosopher Lawrence Lee Young, John Safran. This has been the Conversation Hour.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.